I think it's a great action movie with good special effects, a very strong story, and it's not very often that you get action movies that have a real strong story.
Reading the script, it was one of the best scripts I had ever read. On paper, it was horrifying. I would have to read 4 or 5 pages and take a walk around the block and calm down. It was just really intense.
Michael Biehn and Paul Reiser are good guy and bad guy in the current 20th Century Fox release, Aliens. This is HBO Behind the Scenes.
Although edited for television, tonight's thriller contains scenes of suspense and violence which may be unsuitable for young viewers. Parental discretion is advised.
The timeline is pretty condensed for when I first met this franchise and when we get to the comic books that we're going to be talking about. Growing up, we had quite an extensive home video collection at the house because for every couple of months, HBO used to run their free preview weekends where the channel would be available to non-subscribers for, you know, a Saturday and Sunday to entice people to watch their content and then subscribe. During this time, my dad and then a few years later, my brother would get blank VHS tapes, those old like 6 hour tapes in the brown plastic clamshell boxes or whatever. Because of how brief movies used to be, they could record 3 movies onto one of these tapes. We ended up with 100 movies on these blank tapes from the late 70s to mid to late 80s. All different genres, comedies, action, horror, everything. They were kept in our basement, which became my playroom when I was growing up, and I would just live down in the basement first playing with my G.I. Joes or other toys, and then eventually reading my comics. And I always had these movies, and I would just plug one into the VCR and watch the whole thing. So on one of these tapes was, I don't remember what the first one was, but the second movie on it was Ferris Bueller's Day Off, followed by Aliens. And I just remember after the post-credits thing of Matthew Broderick does his little farewell to the camera, the first post-credits MCU stinger, then it went to like this hard cut to like black and this ominous music as these names start going up in blue. And I just knew Aliens, I'm not ready for this one. I knew I was scared. I must have walked in on my parents when they were taping it or something, because I just remember something about this movie. There was a scene where these people were in a red room and something was coming out of the walls or the ceiling or something to attack them. I just had that visual image sense memory, and I was like, nope, this is too scary for me, I'm not even gonna watch it. So I would stop the movie there and like rewind it, and that was me just growing up. Cut to the early 90s, probably around 1992, and I think it was then, because I had a couple of friends, we were just getting into comics, starting to collect. This was right around the Image boom. There was a brief window of like a year and a half to 2 years where me and my 3 or 4 closest friends all collected comics, Marvel trading cards, a few other things. We were all getting into the Image comics just at the time they were opening up and exploding. We were getting collections that complemented each other. So if I got X-Men, my buddy would get Uncanny X-Men. We could double dip and trade back and forth. But I just remember every comic I got that year had a promo for Alien 3. It was just in the back of every comic. You couldn't escape it. So I knew that there was a thing. I kind of knew the shape of the alien. I had seen the commercials for this thing. One day, it was my buddy's birthday party or whatever, and we were still kind of young enough where we could have a sleepover birthday party. I just remember that. And he was having all of us over, and they said they wanted to watch the movie Aliens, and they knew I had it on tape. Okay, yeah, I can bring it over. And I wasn't sure. I was like, all right, I'm bringing this, so it's kind of my responsibility. I'm going to have to watch this. And I wasn't sure if I was going to like it. But we did. After the party and everything, we're all just like camped out on his big couches and sofas around in the dark. We play this movie, and I really didn't know what to expect. But it blew me away. From start to finish, I think me and all of my buddies, like all of us, we had like the same reaction. And now, I'm talking like 5th grade, 6th grade. We're like 10 or 12 or 11, somewhere in that age range. The scenery and the music, I love the score. James Horner's score of that movie, just with this heavy percussion sound of the drum tracks and everything. The music for the Marines and everything, and the look of them, their hardcore toughness, these pulse rifles, how funny Bill Paxton was, how badass Michael Biehn, and it was Janet, the woman who played Vasquez. I love these characters, and I love the world and everything, and the scary parts were scary-ish, but like nothing like freaked me out, like it was like too much for me. I thought of it first and foremost as an action movie more than a horror movie. Just loved it, loved everything about that world, and it just really, I got into it, and we started like playing with stuff like that. And then God, I can't believe they actually made Aliens action figures a few years later that were licensed and marketed to little kids of my age. What franchise do you think you have here? That was just weird. And then so yeah, then a few years years later, I watched the first movie, Alien. I rented that one, which did actually scare me. And then I was kind of like, okay, one of these is distinctly more horror, and one of these is distinctly more action-packed. We were so into it. We loved the Alien movie, and we watched it over and over and over again. And we were also just big into comics. And eventually those two things coincided, because right around then we were seeing Aliens comics, and we were breaking away from the Marvel and DC houses. And I discovered Dark Horse largely through the Star Wars Dark Empire trade, and then they had the Aliens franchise. I remember getting the trade paperback for Genocide, because it had this gorgeous painted cover by Dave Dorman with a queen in the center, and then these two factions of aliens, one black and one red. Looks like they were going at each other. I was like, is this Alien Civil War? What's going on here? Got that one, and then I just went from there, and I was collecting for 4 or 5 years. I was getting a lot of the series and a lot of the one-shots. It was a huge part of me. It's like through high school. Always loved that franchise, yeah.
Michael Biehn, a tough but sensitive warrior in The Terminator, puts on his armor once again in Alien, starring Sigourney Weaver.
When I work on these, a lot of people have asked me, do I feel bad about not being able to be the hero, not being able to be the one at the end who does everything, but it's okay. I mean, both characters that I played were strong male characters, and when I'm working on them as an actor, I never think, oh, well, I'm not going to be in the end of the movie, and this bums me out, or I don't feel good about that. Jim Cameron has given me the opportunity to be in two really, really tremendous movies, and to not be around for the finale and be able to finish off the monster or the monsters, and as the case is in this one, is a small price to pay for, you know, being able to be involved in such a great project.
You've already mentioned that you were a fan of G.I. Joe, and I'm sure you can see the parallels between the two entities.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, like the sort of the paramilitary aspect, the slightly futuristic leading-edge technology with the weapons and gung-ho-ness. I mean, yeah, like Hicks looked like Duke and everything. And yes, because we were still sort of that age, early 90s, we were just about to grow out of G.I. Joe, that first initial phase, but we still had them. We were still playing with the G.I. Joe toys and pretending we would, like, mock up, like, make, like, a fake alien monster for them to fight. And we would basically have, we would interact, like, we'd have our G.I. Joes, like, locked in a room in their headquarters, and pretend it's the scene when the aliens just start coming through the walls and coming out of the ceiling. Rakondo would have the motion tracker or something like that. He would be saying, movement, 6 meters or something. Yeah.
Which Joe is chicken shit Hudson, though?
Oh, God. I never liked Shipwreck. The cartoon always tried to make him sound like Jack Nicholson. Yeah, I didn't like him.
Bean's nemesis in the film is not only the alien, but a character named Burke, played by comedian Paul Reiser.
The main thing is Burke does not start out as a villain. He's a regular corporation guy who has a job to be done. And as time goes on and pressure gets greater, his values go out the window. And he does some less than wonderful things. So I was not playing it as a villain, and I was playing it as a regular guy who just does a terrible thing. I think part of being a comic or not being conspicuously villainous or evil-looking works to surprise the audience. They go, oh, this is the guy we like.
Excerpt from the 1997 Aliens Genocide Trade Paperback, 3rd edition, Dark Alleys and Mysterious Mayhem, introduction by Barbara Kessel. Maybe you saw the moody John Bolton cover and decided to check it out. Maybe you remember the powerful Dave Dorman painting from the 1st edition. Maybe you remember back further to the lush Arthur Sadam paintings from the comics issues of Aliens Genocide. Maybe the word was just intriguing in itself. Genocide. Species death. It started with the movies. Alien, Aliens, and Alien 3 created the starting point for a series of Dark Horse comics that expanded the underlying mythos begun in those movies to the point where more story now exists in four-color form than in film stock form. This story is just a small dip of the toe into the fetid waters of Aliens lore. First there were aliens, aliens versus humans, then aliens versus predators. So, one day the thought rang through the halls, what about aliens versus aliens? Now there's an event. Mark Verheiden, scripter of the first 3 volumes of Dark Horse's Aliens Tales, was busy at work on Predator, so he needed a new guy. Somebody knew how to spin a yarn made of equal parts acid and glory. Somebody with a twisted sensibility capable of monstrous mayhem and spellbinding storytelling. Somebody like John Arcudi. Arcudi is one of the cleanest writers in the business. Not in the sense of, this one's for children, but the kind of lucid, flawlessly paced scene setting that gets across a universe of ideas, with every carefully chosen phrase and efficiently paced scene. There's no unnecessary purple prose here, just the characters, ma'am, and no extra words to bring attention to the writer's extensive collection of Learn a Word a Day calendars. Wish I had that talent. Arcudi's also a delightfully scary-looking guy. When those soul-killer eyes make contact, they inspire thoughts of dark alleys and mysterious mayhem, dread deeds and terrifying tales, making him the perfect image of the horror story writer. Joke is that he's really extremely personable and outrageously well-read. Anybody who reads Benchley, Robert that is, and knows the Algonquin Round Table didn't include King Arthur as tops in my book. Enter the artist. Damon Willis didn't have a lot of professional credits under his belt when his samples got him the genocide job, and he clearly had no idea what he was getting himself into. He said he wanted to draw aliens. We said, okay, here are some aliens. Oh, and give us two separate species, note the subtle differences between the two queens, and about 5 million of each type, okay? When I saw the original art for the first page of issue 3, I laughed out loud and asked Damon where to look to find Waldo. The boy does not skimp on the detail. Next step was making sure none of those aliens lost any detail. Carl Story's a detail man. Think of him as the hand polish of inkers. The pages always come back sparkling. An inker obliterates the original pencils in the process of changing them to ink lines. Carl's one of the few names that makes pencilers sigh in contentment. They know he won't do them wrong. The wash of Arthur Sadam's watercolors mimics the acidic sheen of the aliens, giving genocide that great ooky feel. While color separation technology has improved dramatically since the system used to produce the film for this book, it's still possible to appreciate the textures and washes that were impossible to produce mechanically at the time. Sounds like I'm talking decades ago, right? As computers go, it's been geological eras.
When Sigourney Weaver first met the creature in Alien, her whole crew was wiped out. In Aliens, it's 57 years later, and she's back, this time with the Marines.
Alien was a suspense movie. To me, it was like walking down a dark alley, slowly knowing something's out there, and at any minute it could jump out at you. Where Aliens is much more of an action movie than a suspense movie, and it's more like the scares and thrills that you get from a roller coaster ride. It's exciting and scary as compared to being like visceral and scary like the first one was.
People have a lot of preconceived notions about this going into it, and they go, oh, I remember the first one, I'll bet you it's in the cat. We remember the first time the android was the villain. So we have this kind of sinister-looking android. The thing that amuses me is that people actually laugh during the film at the fact that they're being so manipulated. They go, oh, you're not going to do this to us. And they go, yes, he is. Where Newt is submerged in water, and you just know that somewhere in that murky water is one of these aliens. You just go, don't do this to the kid. No, he's going to get the kid.
The kid is 9-year-old Carrie Henn, who plays Weaver's adopted daughter, Newt.
She'd never worked in a movie before. She was always there, and it was kind of funny because when she first started off, it was all sort of, I could tell she was sort of in awe of it all and didn't really know what was going on. And towards the end of the shoot, it was like, Bane, you're not on your mark. So she got a little worldly.
So you said that you got the genocide tray because you specifically referenced the Dave Dorman cover. So where did you get that at?
I remember picking it up at a mall, so it would have been a Walden Books. It wasn't at the local comic book store. I had like three options for comic book stores. There was like the one that was like really close, like in bike distance, Fantasy Comics. And then there was a college bookstore, Northern Lights bookstore, that did have a decent graphic novel section. That was actually, I don't know if I separated these things in my mind or some of them just based on the type of store they were. Just tended to have a little bit more of a niche because Northern Lights, that was the college bookstore, they had more Dark Horse stuff and also a lot more Vertigo. That was where I discovered Hellboy. That was where I discovered Sandman Mystery Theater. And I was picking up issues and stuff from that place. Those probably would have been at the normal comic book store, but I don't remember ever picking them up there. And then there was another place called Silversmith that had a lot more back issues, quarter bins and stuff like that, and like just like shelves of them. And I could go find earlier stuff in my G.I. Joe and X-Men collection. Boggles my mind now that when I was in sixth grade, I could ride my bike to three different comic book stores. The Eagle Grocery that had comics available too.
Do you remember what your first Aliens floppy was?
One of my friends was collecting issues of Colonial Marines, and I didn't have those. I think I collected Labyrinth, all four issues, before I got the trade of that. I don't remember exactly which one. I got the three issues of Alien 3, of the movie adaptation, too. So that probably would have been first. I don't remember why or how exactly I got them, or possibly a friend got them and just like gifted them to me because he didn't read them. I don't remember buying them off the stand, but I know that I had all three of them in my collection. And I think I read that before I saw the movie. No, I wouldn't have done that. I would have seen the movie on, I didn't see the movie in the movie theater, but I saw Alien 3 on VHS. VHS as soon as it came out. And I think I was trying to read the comics to see if the story made a little bit more sense or if it filled in some of the gaps in the movie. That had the really cool Arthur Sydam covers, who also did Genocide. Of course, I didn't know that at the time because I didn't see the covers for Genocide. I'm trying to think. I wasn't collecting like the Dark Horse Presents, like the anthologies or anything. The one shots that I was getting, they were probably more in that between 95 and 97.
So did you had the chance to read The Alien?
I never read that one until decades later. This is in late 2000s, probably like 2009, 2010-ish. I got the first two volumes of the Aliens Omnibus published by Dark Horse. And these are the volumes with like the white spine and trade dress that are sized down from the normal comic book format. And actually, it's not digest size. It's bigger than that. Closer to manga size or something like that, or a little bit bigger. But yeah, smaller than the normal comic book size. The first Omnibus volume collects the three big story arcs that you've already covered. Outbreak, or as it was called, A Nightmare Asylum, Earth War / Female War, and then The Alien is at the very end of this. And then volume two starts with Genocide.
The tinfoil hat conspiracy theorist wants me to think that they did those because they wanted to devalue them. Since they were putting so many comic books into one big fat economical volume, I was like, okay, well, they want to make sure that they take some of the value away so you'll still buy the regular trade paperbacks if you really like something. But the realist to me is that, no, it costs less money for them to produce that much paper. And so it was just about being cost effective. So
yeah.
Just to cover the original presentation, The Alien debuted in Dark Horse Presents, quote unquote, annual number 56. They replicated one of the 1950s style DC annuals on the cover, specifically a Superman annual. And of course, they're somewhat parodying it by putting Violent Marv kicking a guy in the face in place of Superman appearing to be like an Oscar trophy or something. The first part came out on November 5th, 1991. And in that annual, you had the third installment of Next Men. You had the seventh installment of Sin City. You had the third installment of The Creep. You had the story Fancies by Joe Duffy and Jovan Chacon. You've got The True Chronicle of Eldigitha by Rick Geary. You've got The Trouble with Kibbles featuring the Earth Boys by Cliff Biggers, Brett Brooks, and Dave Johnson. Do you know Biggers and Brooks?
No, I don't.
Did you ever read Comic Shop News?
No, not regularly. I had like an issue or two handed me down, but no.
Yeah, that was the newspaper that was given out at comic shops for free. You could order them in bundles of, I think, 50 or 100. And especially back in the early 90s, they were something of a staple. You knew you were in a proper comic shop if they gave away copies of CSN.
Yeah.
Biggers and Brooks were the guys who ran that newspaper, and might still to this day, for all I know. So I'm sure that there might have been some crossovers, like, hey, you like comic books? You want to do some comic books? But I'm sure it didn't hurt Dark Horse's fortunes to have the guys who ran CSN do a story for Dark Horse Present.
I think I got those a lot. I don't think I read them very often. I think it was probably something, it was like just an insert thrown in my bag with whatever I was given.
Did you do anything with Advanced Comics or previews in the catalogs?
No, not really. I collected previews for a little while, but I never really used them for ordering. It was more just informational to look what was coming out.
For me, I was reliant on the newsstand for most of the 80s and into the early 90s. And so my brother would have access to comic shops, and he'd bring his CSNs with him when we would hang out, or they'd be at his house when we'd hang out. And so that was the only way I could get into news of the broader comic book sphere until I started getting previews catalogs, and then CSN seemed kind of irrelevant. But in those days, that was one of the few information sources I had, especially for somebody who didn't want to spend money on something. And if I did spend money, it'd probably be on a Marvel Age, if anything. So the same week as the Dark Horse Presents annual, you had Aliens Genocide, number one. In the same month, you had Badlands, number five, Billy 99, number three, Chevelle Noir, number 24, Deadline USA, number two, Iron Hand of Almeric, number three, John Byrne's 2112 graphic novel, The Mask, number four, Predator Cold War, number three, Terminator The Enemy Within, number one, Vampirella Morning in America, number two, and Venus Wars, number eight. And we previously covered what books came out from Dark Horse at that particular given month. That's a lot more than we usually would cover, and part of the reason for that is it's been 11 months since Aliens vs. Predator number 4, 13 months since Aliens Earth War number 4, and this is the first alien story to appear in Dark Horse Presents since the 5th anniversary special in March, which was over 7 months prior to the release of this story. A list of books completed since the last single issue of Aliens: Adventures of Luther Arkwright, Concrete Fragile Creature, Dead Face, Doc Stern and Mr. Monster, Give Me Liberty, Indiana Jones and the Fate of Atlantis, Outlanders, Predator 2 Adaptation, Predator Big Game, Race of Scorpions, Starstruck, Tank Girl, the Terminator, the first miniseries that Dark Horse did, the Terminator one-shot with the fold-out greeting card centerfold, the entire miniseries Terminator Secondary Objectives. I always think of Aliens being this perpetual thing that Dark Horse did for 30 years straight. And clearly from this, they took a year off between series, and it just kind of boggles my mind that you didn't have that constant presence of Aliens on the newsstand. Since we hadn't really addressed this aspect before, but I have some numbers from Capital City Distribution to get a sense of how the various Alien series did. The second Aliens miniseries, the color one with the Den Boves art, sold in the realm of 30,000 copies an issue. Yeah, I think it bottomed out at 26,000 copies an issue. Aliens Earth War had an interesting arc because through Capital City, the first issue sold 50K, the second issue was 41K, the third issue was 43K, and the fourth issue was 45K. So you see, you had a little bit of dip in the middle, and then it was coming back up again. I think the Sam Keith art had a lot to do with that. Mm-hmm. And then you look at Aliens vs. Predator, debuted with 95K, second issue was 66, third was 57, fourth was 54. Aliens vs. Predator, even if this isn't total numbers, this is just one distributor, and not even necessarily the largest distributor. I think even then they were number two behind Diamond. But it gives you a sense of the magnitudes of improvement in sales from the earlier series into the present. So where is Aliens after that year off? Well, Genocide number one sold 59,000 copies through Capital City, which was more than half of Aliens vs. Predator, more than the entirety of Earth War. So at this point, in terms of single issues, Genocide number one is probably the best-selling single issue of an Aliens-only comic book. Second issue sold 43K, third 37K, and the fourth 34. It comes out big, probably something of an Iron Man 3 bump, where after Aliens vs. Predator, there's a hunger for new Aliens content. But I'm guessing that maybe it wasn't as well-received as it could have been, because you do have a steady slide by almost 50% by the time you're getting to the last issue of the miniseries. Also for comparison, the Predator initial miniseries was definitely not at Aliens levels. And obviously, it had not had the impact culturally so far that Aliens had, because the first miniseries was only selling 16K, second issue 15, and by the last issue, though, it did have that upward trajectory of 21,000, which is considerably more than the first issue, obviously. By the time you get to Big Game, the numbers are corrected. I think retailers are realizing that the Predator is a draw. Much higher sales, 54K, 47K, 42K, and 45K. So again, it starts to come back up toward the end. And then with Cold War, the direct continuation of the first miniseries, opens at 56K, which is the highest of any of them so far, followed by 43, 41, and 37. So it did have a downward trajectory. You didn't have that pickup, but you can definitely see that the numbers are starting to correct for the popularity of the Predator.
Do you think the decline of sales for Genocide might have been impacted by the fact that the cast of characters was all new? For the first time, it wasn't relying on established characters from the movie?
I think a lot of it is just natural attrition. The natural trajectory is downward. And so it's something special when you can come back up and especially surpass the first issue. I think it's a simple matter of there's a lot of people anticipating that first issue. A lot of people came to check it out. And just as happens with most comic books, people checked it out. Some liked it, some didn't. The ones who liked it carried on. The ones who didn't fell off. I think it's just as simple as that. It could have also been retailers seeing a new number one and either over-ordering or trying to order at numbers closer to Aliens vs. Predator, sans Predator. We can talk about the actual story. And again, in Dark Horse Presents, it was in black and white initially. The Alien was by John Urquidy. Paul Guinan did the layouts and the inks. Tony Akins did the full pencils, and Willie Schubert did the lettering. And I make a point of mentioning that because when they had the Aliens 30th anniversary acknowledgement at Houston's Comic Palooza, he was the letterer of the book, and they brought him in the group. And that is one of the only times I've been to a convention that had letterers, and especially when the letterer was part of a broader reunion. I just had to give a shout out to Willie Schubert. Plus, I actually approached Schubert about trying to do a logo for Roll Spine Podcast before we had one. Ultimately, Mac ended up designing one for us, but he was one of a few different letterers, and I believe the first one I ever approached about trying to do a logo. And the problem was he said that his hands weren't what they used to be anymore, his eyes weren't what they used to be, he wasn't doing a lot of hand lettering anymore, he certainly wasn't doing it at a convention, and we were going to get back with each other, but it never actually happened. So I just want to give a shout out to Willie Schubert. Cool. So do we want to talk a little bit about the story?
Yeah, I've read this in the collection, so my version of it is colored. This one, it picks up after the Earth War, the female war. This kind of is explaining a little bit in like very kind of rush terms how the Earth is able to recover after being nuked and be like the irradiated wasteland from the last story. And we see that the space jockey, that ship has been in orbit over the Earth, has basically been terraforming the Earth over time and rehabilitating it. The story is set around the president and a small delegation going to meet the space jockey and actually have a face-to-face encounter with a presumably non-hostile alien. And the whole thing is that, you know, he sends this message to Earth about how this is an historic day, we're going to try try and have these peaceful talks, peaceful coexistence, try and work with another culture to make humanity's future brighter and more prosperous. Of course, that's all bullshit because the military is sending the president and his entourage there as an assassination attempt because they're afraid that this alien is too powerful and can subjugate Earth once it's ready to it. Once the president and his envoys arrive in front of the space jockey, the jockey is telepathically able to determine what their plan is and senses that all of the president's guards and entourage are actually synthetics, and he goes about killing them till one of them actually self-destructs and like sets off a bomb that blows up the space jockey's ship with everybody on board. Oh, and the president kills himself too.
We probably ought to address that. Everybody's been scanned. In fact, they had germs burned off of them and they're covered right. In ash, which removes a layer of skin, which is a little bit questionable given that we find out they're synthetics. Do they have a layer of skin to burn off? I'm not so sure.
Yeah.
They also have some very well done strategic nudity where you don't actually see anything, but because everybody's arms kind of blocking all the goody bits. But I thought that was well designed. They were rendered completely naked, so obviously they can't bring any weapons with them, although the synthetics would themselves be technically weapons. The president has a false tooth, but instead of it being a cyanide capsule, as you'd expect, it probably, presumably, even though they don't actually explain this, it's either Xenozip, which is a drug that we're going to talk about in the comic book story to follow, or is it some sort of accelerant that causes a chest burster to come out of the president? We've seen him acting out earlier in the story, being very curt with people, very hostile, and it becomes clearer why that is the case, because he knows he's on a timer, that he's going to be dying soon, and he's smuggled this chest burster in specifically because one thing we do know that this engineer is afraid of is the aliens, so here's an alien sucker. I do thought it was a little weird that he would have a problem specifically with a chest burster, since there's a little baby alien and there's a great big engineer. I don't think that you would necessarily have that direct out of me onto you kind of situation, but for the purposes of the story, we'll let it slide. What did you think of that twist?
I like the fact that like it's basically a version of the suicide bomber with the president actually having a chest burster inside, but the execution is a little weird again because he has to put the liquid, the Xenozip or something, but it's kind of like, is it a PIM particle? How come he just dabs this on his tongue and all of a sudden the chest burster rips out of him, and the chest burster then knows to shoot out and bite this guy on the neck instead of like running and hiding for its own survival. I liked the idea of sort of weaponizing the chest burster that way. It sort of bumps up against my incredulity. I don't know if that would actually be executed that way. It's a cool idea, and I guess because the story is so short and the ending comes a page later with a giant explosion, it's easy to forget about that. Interesting idea. I'm not sure it was executed as well as it could have been.
I'm willing to give it a pass just because I think that there's some podcaster-itis at play here. You're not meant to think about it too deep. It's supposed to be, hey, that's novel, and you move on. So I think if you just don't think about it, it's fine. But as soon as you start thinking about it, it definitely falls apart. Fellow liberal, were you a little bit disappointed when it was the old white guy who was the president in the future?
Yeah.
I mean, it works out in the end, but in the moment, you're like, oh, really? We're doing this again?
Knowing how the authority figures are painted in this world anyway, it's not surprising.
I like that we get back to Gateway Station, even if briefly.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was interesting that as part of what's essentially a retcon, they make a point of gaslighting Newt's account of what the engineer was, what it could do, and what it had already done on the Earth. I thought that was an interesting way of hitting the reset button on the first miniseries.
Yeah, that's true.
What did you think about the engineer's design? Specifically, it seems like it takes elements from Nelson's, but it definitely seems to go to a slightly different place with it, almost to the point where, to me, it seemed like it had either aged prematurely or was just like more rougher hewn. What do you think about the differences, and just generally, what do you think about the design of the engineer for the comic books? By the way, I just realized I'm already messing up the timeline by even referring to this as an engineer. I really should be saying the jet jockey, right? Space jockey?
Or space jockey, yeah. Yeah, it's an interesting look because seeing it outside of the spacesuit in the sort of like regal robes, like this is what the ambassador would look like. An air of royalty, and you're taking maybe the H.R. Geiger-ness out of it, which when you separate it that much from like that core concept of what it looked like in that first movie, are you sacrificing some of the nature of it? It's a weird creature that I don't know if I needed to see this much of its body outside of the giant hulking spacesuit. Maybe it should have remained more of a mystery, and seeing it like this, welcoming people to a conference of delegates, is a little bit weird. Like, it's shaking hands and then pimp slapping a guy.
I do like that they make him less elephantine. It was a little too much like Babar was going ape shit on the aliens in the original miniseries. It is curious. It's hard for me. I feel like the screenwriters of Prometheus had to have been looking at these comic books, because we've had multiple instances of an engineer type going nuts and just ripping people apart without warning. This sequence in particular is so much like what we had in Prometheus. I feel like that had to be an influence.
Oh, yeah, I definitely see that. It's the fourth from last page. It's the three panels where when it's throwing a left hook at one of the synths and basically just exploding the guy's face. I really like how the engineer is drawn in that one, just kind of like with the wrinkles and there's something about its eyes that just look really intense.
I like the cross eyes, and I like that one shot where he's got the really big, foreshortened Kirby fist smashing.
Yep.
One of them, that looks really cool. I also like the body horror of the synthetics. We know that these aren't real humans, but they're so messed up in ways that are still recognizable as human that you kind of feel for them.
Mm-hmm. And there's no cooler movie in action than ripping somebody's arm off and then using it as a club.
Or video games.
Yeah.
I gotta say, some of these projects that Dark Horse retroactively colors, it just is funky. But this story really was made to be colored. It looks so much less good in black and white. And I do think that you could have done better colors. It's still very flat. You definitely have another instance of them going in there and doing paint fills. But it still needed the color, and it looks a lot better in color, I think, than in black and white.
Well, especially because of the synthetic blood. I mean, if that's not colored a certain way, this whole setup can be very confusing. If you miss something and you're just like, what is happening to these people? If you're assuming this is what's happening to normal humans, that could be messed up.
Yeah, we're going to have a little bit of issue with color going forward on this particular, the next miniseries as well. Is the alien a prologue to Genocide or an epilogue to the Beerhaden trilogy? Because it's advertised as one, but I kind of feel like it's almost more of another.
Because of the nature of how I read it, it's collected with the other with the original trilogies. So I kind of see it as an epilogue to that. It does function transitionally because it establishes how Earth survives and how people continue, and the nature of the aliens and trying to use the aliens as weapons is going to be going forward in a lot of the next couple storylines, and the insistence on capturing them and using their blood or using the jelly. That's going to be a big part of Genocide as well as other stories.
While I'm not a huge fan of gaslighting one of our lead characters, she is the one who has multiple hallucinations over the course of the earlier miniseries. So I guess we can kind of see where she might think that the alien engineer, space jockey, whatever, could do a bunch of stuff that ultimately it couldn't do. And the whole point of the story is to show that the engineer wasn't nearly as omnipotent as she made it out to be. Now, you've gone back and read the earlier miniseries, though. What did you think about the Verhaeden trilogy?
I didn't read them for this podcast. I kind of came down to it with a similar assessment as you and Derek, and when you were talking about them. I thought they were very interesting at the time. They could have done some really captivating things with Newt and Hicks if they were allowed to be those characters, and maybe I don't remember if, like, as I was reading it, I became aware that their identities were changed later and renamed, but I felt like they were interesting, ultimately disappointing. Newt, in particular, the next generation of Ripley, could have been and should have been a really strong, really positive female character. I don't know if she was given enough story to do that, but again, it's been a long time since I've read them myself. I'm kind of just going on what I remember from your discussion with Derek.
How'd you feel about their take on Hicks?
Interesting, because I think we project a lot of what we want onto Hicks from his scenes in the movie. Because the movie really kind of ends on this idea of a family unit, Hicks as a surrogate father figure for Newt works. That's sort of embedded in my mind. Having him be anything other than that, whether it's her perception of him or not, is a little weird.
Genocide issues 1-4 were released monthly. And in fact, in one instance, the final issue, you had two in the same month. I guess it was a longer month. So they came out through January 25th, 1992. The miniseries was plotted by Mike Richardson. This is the first miniseries scripted by John Arcudi, not the last by far. We have art by Damon Willis and Carl C. Story, with Jim Massara providing letters and covers by Arthur Saddam. He also produces the colors for the story. We have essentially Homeworld War. We have a continuation of Alien Earth War, the finale of which involved Ripley ordering a nuke strike on the alien homeworld, thus killing the Super Queen and destroying the primary Genesis hive of the aliens. Because we've established that the aliens are telepathic and that telepathy can cross over through worlds, all of the aliens are somewhat disarrayed as a result of this, and also with the awareness of the death of the ultimate queen mother, they begin trying to create new hives with new queens, which you think would be a thing that would happen anyway, but apparently it's a major issue on the homeworld specifically, because you have the traditional tribe and then you have a mutant offshoot, which if you read the letters columns, the editor points out they shouldn't be quite so red as they appear in the comic book. They were doing that for the comic book purposes to show the difference between the two of them. They shouldn't actually be bright red, but for the purposes of identification, this is an audio podcast, so helps for us to at least tell you a color. So you have the offshoot red aliens, the reformist aliens, who are trying to make sure the hive continues under the assumption that they've lost their queen. And I guess the telepathy doesn't work between the two queens. So you end up with two rival queens with a group of aliens that are described as green, although I see them as more like the black aliens. These two forces apparently go into conflict with one another. Now, supposedly they're starting up at this roughly the same time, because I guess enough of the classic aliens have been wiped out to where they're having to rebuild from scratch, but you'd assume that there'd be a numbers advantage to the dark aliens as opposed to the red ones, since they are new and just being produced. But on the homeworld, you have a war between these two tribes. There's a novelization of the miniseries written by David Bischoff that establishes that this has happened over a span of 20 years. They are much less clear about that in the comic books, and I think actually the safe assumption is that this is happening almost immediately after the other miniseries, since I think that they generally seem to take place around the same time frame, certainly seem to have the same fashions and technology and such, more or less. There are some advances, clearly. The miniseries starts off at the Goodwill Games, which is apparently a replacement for the Olympics. It's hosted in Baghdad, and basically showing that, look, we've gotten rid of the space jockey, rolled back the terraforming, we've been going in there and wiping out the alien infestation of Earth. There are still pockets of alien infestation throughout the Earth. I think they made a mention of like 20 some odd key points that they're still working on, but broadly speaking, the Earth has been reclaimed by humans. They hold this Olympics to show the triumph that they've had of reclaiming their own homeworld, but one of the contestants takes a performance-enhancing supplement. In the book, they make a point of saying that it's illegal. I don't know if it's as clear in the comic, but more or less it is. It's not Slurm, even though that's the first thing that I'm thinking of when I see it. It's fire in the book. In the comic, it's Xenozip. It's a pill that's derived from royal jelly. This is apparently the first reference to royal jelly of the aliens, and apparently this is a excretion of an alien queen that helps to develop an alien queen. Again, I'm getting flashbacks to Futurama. I can't help it. If you get a hold of this stuff, you can dilute it and you can give it to humans, and it basically works as something like a steroid. Plus, I don't know if it does anything mentally. It seems like it doesn't help you mentally. It seems like it's mostly physical, and in some ways it can mess you up. As for instance, a runner in this little Olympics takes the Xenozip, has a bad reaction to it, super speeds, and slams into a pillar and dies. Later on, we see Xenozip given to a soldier that's apparently sensitive to it, goes into a berserker rage, kills a troop of soldiers, even with his own arm ripped off, just going absolutely nuts. I have a cynical view of the military, but I still think that you would not necessarily want to have berserkers who kill everybody in sight on your side, especially when you have other troops that can be killed and you've watched these guys get killed. In general, in my experience, military people tend to have a lot of empathy toward other military people and how they're treated, and certainly don't like to be treated as cannon fodder at any level. But, you know, we're going with the hyper-cynical 80s version of the military, where you've got a high muckety-muck who's like, oh yeah, I want some of that stuff. I want to have my own berserkers. The Xenozip is being produced by a company called the Grant Corporation. This is their introduction into the franchise. They will be appearing again. They are run by a fellow named Daniel Clamp. Daniel Grant, not Trump, although there's definitely some parallels there. And this guy is basically over-leveraged. They've done well with the Xenozip, but if Xenozip is taken off the market because of the synthetic they're using to produce it, to mass produce it essentially, is what's triggering this reaction with the berserkers. And if you have a bunch of berserkers, you're going to have to pull off the market. They can't afford for that to happen. So the only way you can correct for that is to go out and get some more royal jelly. Daniel Grant is concerned about his fortunes. First going to convince the military to fund an exposition to go to the alien homeworld to get some more royal jelly, and he's going to join them on this trip, which in the comic book is made to seem like it's him just watching over his investment. In the book, he's actually in debt to a violent mobster, and he's like, let me get off the planet until I get my royal jelly to make sure nothing bad happens to me. This guy's meeting with military muckety mucks, and he demonstrates a lack of concern for the military men that are going to be going on this mission, and some overt sexism towards one of the military figures that are there. But ultimately, the military wants the bad stuff. They want the synthetics to create their berserkers, so they're willing to fund this expedition to get the royal jelly to make sure that he doesn't go out of business and has something he can sell to the general public. They don't necessarily want the berserkers in the general public either. They all pile up onto the USS Razia. I'm not familiar with Razia. Is that, did you need research into that? Because I didn't.
I didn't. I can't think of what that might be referring to.
So we're aboard the ship. I have to keep reminding myself this is not Daniel Clamp, because there's a lot of similarities to the protagonist-antagonist from the Gremlins sequel. Daniel Grant is aboard the ship, and he's expecting to meet this badass military leader, and he sees a guy, a big old muscular Arnold Schwarzenegger-looking dude. That turns out to be Corporal Laurels Hendrickson, and instead he's meeting Major Alex Lee, a female who was actually at the meeting, the one that he was sexually harassing or being misogynistic towards in the meeting. In the book, she's Colonel Alexandria Kozlowski. Don't know why there's a change. Not really that relevant, because this character is going to appear after this miniseries. Sorry, spoiler. Actually, none of these characters will be getting out of this miniseries. They're all going off to get the royal jelly. They're also trying out new technologies, doing some experimentation. There's a cute bit at the opening of the second issue where they've created holograms, lifelike holograms they can project. And they'd already set that up in the previous issue by talking about where do you want to shoot an alien. They apparently recommend that their soldiers kneecap aliens, because if you go for the head or the chest, you're going to have a lot of spray of acid blood, and they're trying to minimize that. They want to knock out the alien without doing themselves harm. They're basically trying to clear away, not necessarily exterminate, at least not exterminating without having the control over the splatter after shooting the things down. The Major actually uses one of these holograms to screw with the Rich Boy when he's waking up out of his hibernation tank, and that's how they open up the second issue. We see she gets introduced to a Black Ops program that they're doing inside the ship, where they've cloned bodies out of the genetic material of Daniel Grant, but they're not doing the whole body. They apparently use these to harvest for organ donation. So it's just essentially the torso, with the intention of chest bursting an alien out of there, which they're intending to nurse with the royal jelly into a queen. The soldiers aren't necessarily too happy to find out about this going on, but it's not really their purview to say anything about it. If the military says it's okay for them to be doing this, and they're the ones who are helping him to get to the homeworld, they're like, okay, well, we don't like it. Fine, whatever, you're going to do what you're going to do. We're introduced to some of the Colonial Marines on the mission. I did not bother to know these guys' names. One of them plays a saxophone. He's kind of a jerk. Thinks that the Lars Hendrickson guy is a synthetic. He's got a black friend who is my black friend. That's the role he's going to play in this, is he's the friend of the guy who plays the saxophone. The Major guy, the corporal guy, the muscle-bound dude, he overhears the hornblower guy thinking that he's a synthetic, gets really mad about it, knocks the guy around, is offered Xenozip as a bribe to like back off. He admits to having a sensitivity to it, wants nothing to do with it. Finally, Daniel Grant sort of talks this guy down. We get introduced to a lot of the new advancements in this miniseries, specifically the Z-110 acid-neutralizing combat wardrobe, which is filled with Neutrogel. Basically, what they've done is, instead of trying to come up with armor to prevent themselves from getting burned with alien acid, they've got these pouches that have a base that neutralizes the acid, so you can have close combat with the aliens without the blood giving you problem. It's an exosuit, so I guess that's going to make up for the weight of the gel, but I do think it'd be somewhat inhibitive to have wet bags all over yourself. But this is how they're going to neutralize the alien acid. Somebody performs an act of sabotage. They go into where the chest burster is slowly developing into a full-grown alien, apparently, or a queen, and they blow it away. Some of the scientists have a particularly paternal reaction to the death of the alien. You killed my baby! That never really gets played up on, but the assumption is that this is an act of sabotage. Now, I'm thinking that if you've exposed soldiers to an alien on board, one of them might freak out or just be vengeful and kill it, and that's the motivation. But immediately, possibly because of paranoia on his part, possibly justified, Daniel Grant immediately jumps toward sabotage. But there's also a doctor that he himself brought on board, Dr. Amos Begg Bengali, who is very Desaad. He actually looks a lot like Desaad without the robe. You can tell that he's up to something, but you're not quite clear what, but he's constantly giving you these side eyes where you're, that kind of bullshit.
I hear Peter Lorre's voice from him whenever he talks.
Yes, I can hear that. So they finally make it to the planet, the home world, and one of my bones of contention with this miniseries is they start putting up essentially force fields around their ship to prevent themselves from being attacked by the aliens. Now, one of the reasons why they went to the alien homeworld is under the premise that after the destruction that had been wrought and the changes to the constituency of the aliens, that they're going to be more docile, basically. They're on their home turf. They're not as aggressive. There are apex predators on this world that actually eat the aliens, which we've established in the other miniseries. So we're not going to have to worry about the aliens as much. They're going to have their own problems, and they're just not going to be as aggressive. Well, they're in the midst of a civil war. They're actually more aggressive than ever, and they're swarming the place. So this is going to be a problem for our team. Thankfully, they have their tech, and they find ways of slowly pushing out the perimeter. It doesn't work out great for them, though. Ultimately, they lose a lot of men. As a result of these lost troops, Rich Boy, Grant, actually tries to go ahead and get himself into one of the neutralizing suits and go help. But not only has his suit been sabotaged, again, that word, but also somebody has stuffed an egg in the closet. A facehugger comes out, goes after him. It's ultimately killed by the Major. And then we start having Grant talk a lot about his concern for the troops, the resources that are being lost over the course of getting the royal jelly, his feelings of deep guilt and shame over that occurring. Not only is there a manpower issue, but also just the moral imperative that they're going to continue to go after the royal jelly, that he's going to have to suit up and go in there and help them. The plan they come up with is they launch tactical nukes against the red alien's hive. They are able to determine where that is from space. They nuke it from space. Supposedly, because you've nuked one hive, it's supposed to calm the other aliens down, which apparently happens. Because you have a thinning of the numbers, they're able to go into the black alien's hive to go after their royal jelly. They do meet resistance, but they're able to overcome much of that. Weirdly, most of the fourth issue, or at least half of it, is these guys running around in these suits without faces. They look like the mindless ones. It's really hard to tell any one person from another, and I definitely felt some distance from the characters because they all just become this faceless mass. But they make their way to the alien queen. They get the royal jelly that they're looking for. The person who's most excited about it is the doctor guy, the evil doctor guy. At this point, Rich Guy, Grant, has already determined that this is the saboteur and decides to confront him within the alien hive, which is not a great idea. And while they're fighting over that, the scientist gets his head smashed open by jackhammer jaws. Whether or not he's a saboteur is no longer relevant in that particular moment because he is now dead. However, unfortunately for them, the real saboteur turns out to be Corporal Lars Hendrickson, which if you subscribe to Nabokov's gun, you pretty much already figured out because we're running out of people who could potentially be the saboteur that haven't been named. I should probably point out too, the Hornblower guy was killed in one of those initiatives, so that took him off the board. So it's basically down to Lars or my black friend. The Major and the Rich Guy managed to overcome Lars. She ends up getting nailed in the hip, and so she's dead weight. But again, Grant's a changed man, so not only is he going to take on Lars on his own, but he's also going to make sure to help the Major. The way he ultimately does that is that he shoves a bunch of the Xenozip into Lars's mouth, triggering a berserker rage attack, and they use that to send him against the aliens. Now, I don't know why he'd necessarily go immediately after aliens rather than killing the Major and Grant, but story. I should point out that he was working for MedTech and all that stuff about him potentially being a synthetic. It's all just a red herring, it detracting from him being a part of this group that's going to also continue out of the miniseries, this rival corporation. So they get back to the ship. One of the aliens manages to grab onto their entry point. And so my black friend throws a saxophone, which is apparently strong enough to knock the alien off of the ship, and they fly away. The story closes with the alien sort of doing a sad saxophone riff, holding the saxophone as the ship's escaping. It's also worth noting that in the novelization, the Major had lost a lover that was under her command. While there's some inference of this in the comic book miniseries, in the actual novelization, they confirm that she ends up dating Grant at the end of the story. So I guess my first question is, why do they keep making novelists adapt four-issue comic book miniseries? How messed up is that?
I don't know. I did get one of the novels, but it wasn't for this one. Or maybe I might have gotten two of the novels. Yeah, I don't know. That's interesting. Some of the, like, the aspect about, like, the being in debt to the gangster in the novelization, that I actually would have liked to see more of that play out, because I think the character of Galt or Grant is probably the biggest problem I have with the story. Well, one of them.
The Freudian slip of Galt, I think, was somewhat telling.
And I like the Daniel Klein references too. I was thinking about that as well.
Well, I mean, he even kind of looks like him. You notice?
Yeah. No. Yeah. Yeah. There's a thing about it, and yeah, he's sweaty in a couple pages in the first issue. As silly as it is, I think the final shot of the alien holding the saxophone is kind of interesting, just because the saxophone as an instrument looks kind of weirdly phallic and curved and weirdly like the alien species. It kind of has like an H.R. Geiger look to it, like a saxophone.
Sexy sax, man.
Sexy.
This was your first Aliens miniseries. What was your reaction in the time period and your reaction 30 years later?
My big takeaway at the time period was a little bit disappointed, but not really sure why. I didn't know why I didn't like the story as much. Part of it I knew was the art, although it wasn't a criticism of the art, because I liked a lot of the action parts. I liked when like the alien hologram surprises Grant when he's waking up from his thing. I thought that shot was great. The shots of suspense, like when the facehugger attacks in the ship, I thought that was cool. And I liked the imagery of the soldiers just mowing them down with their guns or whatever. And then whenever the alien rips off somebody's head, all of the action stuff I thought was really, really cool. But in terms of just some of the basic design stuff, like I understood that for tactical purposes, they need to be wearing these new suits. And I liked that they weren't just armor. It's not just like we're just putting them down in like these heavily armored plates. They actually thought about it to like have like them like with these like almost like packs of like this neutralizing agent that like takes care of it so that it's not acidic anymore. I was like, oh, that actually makes sense. And it's interesting. They're not just Iron Man or like mech soldiers or something. A little bit different, but I like the thought that went into that. At the same time, early 90s or mid 90s, whenever it was that I read this, I was so in love with the basic look of the Colonial Marines from Aliens. That type of camouflage with the chest plate and the shoulder pads and those armors and those guns. I really wanted to see more of that. So to get a comic where the soldiers don't look anything like that, they're just in these blobby white armor suits with generic guns, it felt like a step down. As much as the action and choreography, as much as I could follow it, like when the soldiers touched down, I thought those scenes were cool. I just wished the designs to look more like the movie. I wanted more reference material from the movie, especially since this was my first exposure of seeing the aliens in another kind of media that wasn't that movie, really. It was jarring a little bit. I remember at the time wondering, and this was still my question that I have today, why was this called Genocide? Why that name? Because of what that implies? What does that have to do with the story? Why was it important that there are two different factions of aliens having this war that really doesn't feel like it has any strong effect on the story? Their plan is a little bit changed because now they're facing a lot more combat, a lot more threats than they were expecting to. Kind of ramps up the tension a little bit, but any other story idea could have explained why they were meeting more resistance than they expected. You didn't necessarily have to imply that there are interfactions and warfare between the aliens with different subgroups and genetic mutants that are different colors. There were like two different ideas here that were smashed together, and the whole thing of dealing with the alien biology and these different factions just wasn't really developed and wasn't necessary for this story, and still doesn't explain why it's called Genocide, because that's not the thing.
I was looking up information on Genocide, so I used that word as the search word. I'm surprised at how few comic books have used the word Genocide. I know it's a very heavy word, mm-hmm. a very triggering word. It's funny because I've been doing that project as Siskoys, who's editing, and I've become very conscious of how often I've used the word genocide over the course of writing stuff for that project. It's probably too heavy a word to be using in that context. It conjures so much imagery, and it's so potent, and you can definitely do an entire miniseries just on what that word would mean in the context of these two alien factions trying to eradicate one another. That's the story.
Right.
Why are we spending so much time on the royal jelly stuff? The story should have been called Royal Jelly or Xenozip or something, because that's what the story's about. The
thing, during your synopsis, I looked up razzia. It's a French word. It means raid, and it's specifically like a police raid at dawn. That could have been cool. The name for the story. Like, raid is basically this group trying to raid the hive for and steal this jelly and get out of there before the aliens get them.
You may notice over the course of the podcast, I've pretty much refused for the most part to acknowledge the renaming pattern that Dark Horse took on for the earlier miniseries. Now, you're somebody who was exposed to most of the miniseries after the renaming convention at REC. taken hold, which makes sense. It's funny that they didn't change the name of this one, since that would have actually made sense, because this is what the story is about. Yeah, call it Raid, call it Royal Jelly, call it anything but genocide. They've actually made action figures, the two warring alien tribes. And it's like, I want to read that story. That's a way more interesting story than what we're getting here. They got in this habit a little later on of doing like these 10 and 12 issue miniseries. That's where you have the genocide story. I don't know that they ever go there. I know one of the novels, DNA War, I think it's called, goes there as one of the original novels, but I don't think they ever addressed in the comic books. And obviously, if you're making action figure representations, there's an interest there. Why hasn't anybody ever done that story? It seems like it's just right there and they're just missing it.
Getting back to the other question of my problems today, looking at it 30 something years later or however much. Yeah, I mean, the protagonist is the CEO of a pharmaceutical company. Okay.
It's like following a book about Martin Scully. What the hell?
Yeah.
Like, and Martin Scully's the good guy who has the major turn for no real reason.
There's lots of great literature and stories and art about terrible people. I was like, okay, if you're going to be the protagonist. But like the first issue, he's a shitbag. You know, like, yeah, it's like, this is a terrible guy. He blows up at people. He's afraid of going bankrupt. He's kind of desperate. He's lashing out at people. He's openly sexist. And then he changes to try and be more sympathetic, but I don't know why he changes or what really causes that turn in him. And I think part of it is Major Lee, Alex, the only real female character. I want to say she's a good character and maybe the only really likable character in the story, except for the fact that she does kind of fall for this guy's bullshit by the end of it.
Ultimately, she doesn't get to do much. It's like, you're expecting her to be the Ripley, and she's kind of the damsel in distress by the end there. Yeah, and she falls for the creep. She's almost like a walking stereotype.
Right. But she calls him out early on as like, he's, you know, playing the great white hunter. I'm like, yeah, there is this safari aspect of the story, which is, again, not a sympathetic story or a way to endear me to the character. Like, for some reason, he suddenly becomes sad when the first couple of Marines or soldiers die, and he says he needs to be on the front lines. He has this moral responsibility to get the job done himself, so no more innocent soldiers have to die. I was like, where is that coming from? Because you still have this vested financial stake, so I'm not sure if I can buy this change of heart from you.
The one that I hook on to the most is that when they have the news hit that you have the berserkers being created by the Xenozip, he goes to the head of, I guess, production or one of his head scientists, and he's literally choking the guy out on his desk. And what I'm picturing, I know people weren't as woke back in the 90s. I wasn't as woke back in the 90s. I can't cast aspersions. But that's one of those red flags. A guy who beats his gal is going to be able to do other things. We know this now, and we kind of knew it even back then. When you are willing to cross the line where you're in a professional relationship with somebody, you're in the workplace, and you're putting your hands around their throat and choking them, and he doesn't stop until people start to gather and watch him choking this guy who is smaller than him and is not seeming to be able to defend himself. If you're that guy, you're not going to be empathetic. You're also the guy who creates clones and is creating chest bursters, and you're just seeing that as meat. You have to know going into the situation that people are going to die. And I realize that it can change you to be on the ground watching that happen, but we've established that this guy has clearly a lack of empathy, egocentric, narcissistic. You don't buy it. And four issues isn't enough time for them to show him slowly progress and for him to rapidly progress. I feel like he's going to end up killing the Major at some point later on down the line. There's another twist that should have come, you know, where he isn't such a good guy after all, because he hasn't had time to evolve naturally. And so you need a rationale for why you'd have that sudden turn, and it's not enough to suddenly realize, oh my gosh, people are going to die? It's like, no shit, you knew going into this. This isn't a shocker. You definitely need to have a dark night of the soul, and that never happens. The closest you have is when he's freaking out over the awareness that there's a saboteur on board, which again is a leap for him at the time, but the story bears it out. Yeah, it's very unnatural, and this guy is not my protagonist. And I do wonder if the intention was for these people to carry on. You know, they did survive, which is not the thing you expect to happen in an alien story. And they didn't. So maybe they weren't well received, or maybe they were designed to be used again and creators didn't like them and didn't want to use them again. But it feels like there was an intention there that was never manifested following this miniseries.
Yeah, I think you're right in all of that, but it's compounded because not only does he not have that dark night of the soul, he doesn't see the three ghosts of Christmas, past, present, future that change him and make him a good moral person who cares about these people. We don't see that. We don't know why he suddenly behaves good, but he also doesn't have any real sort of comeuppance plot-wise. I mean, he saves the day. He gets his ultimate objective. They go in there. He gets the royal jelly that's going to save his company. He gets the girl, confronts the saboteur, who is physically bigger and stronger than him, and yet he still manages to beat him down physically and win and turn that guy loose. He has this turn that you would assume a Mary Sue character in fan fiction. It's like all of a sudden this guy who we should hate all of a sudden just turns good, and all of the good things happen to this character just because he's the protagonist. What the fuck, dude? This is just bad characterization. I don't like this guy, and I don't want him to win. I don't want him to get away and have his happiness at the end. This is bad.
I'm putting my tinfoil hat back on. Here's my theory. We saw the original Verheiden trilogy. I've discussed my issues with that story arc. And then there's a new arc. They actually make a point of resetting so that we can start fresh with the aliens after this long gap in publishing. You have some fruit from Poisonous Tree. Since they're continuing the story, we're stuck with things like the telepathic aliens, the home world. Had enough encounters with the aliens now that you would expect them to come up with tactical advantages over them, which is how you end up with the guys running around with the sacks all over themselves. Which, again, I agree, it's not a good look. The premises advanced in the earlier miniseries were forced from this point to start having those advantages. We're forced to address what was already done in those miniseries, even though they make a point of doing a reset where we shouldn't have to deal with that stuff, or maybe wouldn't have to as much, but we still are, and we're making new mistakes besides. We're doing new goofy stuff where it's like, why do we have force fields? Aliens is not a force fields franchise. You know, we're supposed to be ground level, grease and ooze and like real shit, organic shit, machinery shit, extrapolation of where we are now, not the fanciful notions of ray guns. And so the common denominator is Mike Richardson. Once again, he's the plotter. We know that he's the one who had the initial premise for what the early miniseries is going to be. We know that he's had a strong hand in things. And he's another really tall guy who seems to be telling writers what to do in their stories. It's hard not to feel like this isn't post-Secret Wars Jim Shooter kind of shit. Aliens was a hit. I think he maybe thinks that he has to continue to control the company and control the direction of Aliens, that he's part of the essential ingredients making this work. I think he's actually fucking shit up. I'm wondering if maybe that's part of the problem. I'm wondering if maybe Fox had issues and that's why there was such a long period. I'm wondering if he had trouble finding somebody who wanted to work under those marching orders, creative-wise. I feel like there was something to this. Everything I've read that Mike Richardson has done in relation to the Aliens, I've not been particularly impressed by or happy with. And I feel like he's the problem here. I think he's the one who keeps pushing Aliens into places where they shouldn't have been.
I don't know enough about him, or even really John Arcudi, although I've read other John Arcudi stuff, but I don't know much about them to know. On the previous episode, you were talking about sort of the timeline. When did Alien 3 come out in relation to the other miniseries?
It's not out yet, but when you read the little miniseries, they're talking about it coming. If I remember correctly, the letters column is discussing how the film was going to open in October of that year, and that it had been pushed, and I believe this is at the beginning of the miniseries, so that would have been 91, and it had been pushed to summer of 92. They're talking about who's working on the miniseries and stuff, so they know what's going to happen to Alien 3. And that's part of why I'm sure that they have to back off of the Ripley Hicks new story arc and come up with a new direction, which I'm sure also contributed to the gap, but
that's,
they know
that's
what's
what
coming.
I'm thinking yeah. That probably had a lot to do with why there was a 9 month or 8 or 12 month gap between the issues. Yeah,
they know what's coming. I do think there's an element of response to what they know is coming that we don't know is coming yet.
If I could do like the who's editing, or if I could play with the story, like just based on the plot, okay, you need Grant, if he's a protagonist, you need him to have a bad ending just because he's a bad character, and we need it to see that bear out. But if you want plot-wise, the company to still get its royal jelly and everything, then write the last chapter or something so that maybe somebody's hurt, but they sort of establish that the royal jelly can turn a chess purser into a queen. Like they were going to sort of like feed it, and then once they have their own queen that can make their own royal jelly, they don't need to do these return trips to the planet. They'll be able to reproduce the royal jelly on their own forever, and then the company can continue to thrive. Maybe they do something where, you know, like his plan has fucked up so badly and he got so many of these soldiers killed that they kind of turn against him. And maybe that Dr. Bagali guy, that shifty Peter Lorre looking guy, ends up putting the facehugger on on Grant, and like the last thing, like he wakes up and before he the chestburster eats him, he's like, "Hey, don't worry, we're gonna use the royal jelly to turn your chestburster into the queen, and you're gonna get to birth this new thing that will keep your company going forward. So don't worry, Grant Corp will survive, or Neopharm, whatever the company is, will survive because of you and your dedication," or something like that. So he ends up meeting a terrible fate, but plot-wise, you know, and the major that he was so sexist to, she can just watch this and be like, yeah, you deserve this shit.
And I don't know if mine is the lighter or darker take. I actually think you can pretty much tell the same story, but don't play it as though he's a good guy, he's had a change of heart. Just let him continue to be the jerk. Maybe he saves the major, maybe he doesn't, but continue to let us know that this guy's still a scumbag. Play it as though he's a scumbag who's getting his way, and that all these people have died, but he got what he wanted, and he's the victor. Again, the great white hunter. Just lean into the fact that that's the way this plays out, is Martin Shkreli wins the story.
But then I think, sort of like what the novelization would do, I think we need another external motivation for why he's there at all. Why is he putting his own ass on the line?
Yeah, because apparently he's ultimately a good guy. He's just an abusive, misogynist asshole, money-grubbing piece of shit, but also really good guy deep down. I know his soul. I know his heart. Back in the Catch-as-Catch-Can days, back before I had access to comic shops on a regular basis, one of my friends when I was living in Colorado had this first issue with the Arthur Sadam cover with the red blood. And a lot of people get bent out of shape over this series because they show the aliens having red blood throughout the series. Now, for me, that graphic, that image is kind of burning in my brain because to me it seems so violent to show the red blood, because in my mind that registers as that's human blood on the alien, not the alien bleeding.
Mm-hmm.
And it's such a bright red, yellow red that it almost feels like it's too big for aliens. It's like so red that it should be more like a gore core, I think you would call it, where it's like that really super gory horror movie, that kind of blood, to have it right there on the cover. I remember it's striking, but it also feels like it's maybe the wrong mood for aliens. And then as miniseries progress, so Dan does more covers that are a little bit more in the horror vein, a little bit more Warren throwbacks to some degree, 70s vibe to it.
Yeah, they have more kind of alien landscapes and showing the creature amongst a background too.
Yeah, and with skulls and stuff.
Yeah.
Apparently the third issue cover, which is an alien just sort of creeping around, let's say it's a graveyard, essentially an alien graveyard. Mm-hmm. Apparently that's one of the most reprinted covers where it's been used multiple times in places. What do you think about the covers by Sodam? Because that's just whenever I think of Genocide, I always picture that one image from issue number one. You picked up the trade of the Dave Dorman cover though, and there's also a John Bolton cover which features the scientist holding the severed alien head. What do you think of all that cover imagery, and which ones do you like and dislike?
I have seen the Bolton cover too. Yeah, I forgot about that one. I liked the Dave Dorman cover just because it made such an impression on me at the Civil War with the different factions on the different sides and everything like that. I would see the Sidum covers when I flipped through like long boxes and looking at Aliens comics when I was like looking for other stuff, and I was just like, oh, Genocide, oh, I've read that. So I never bothered to pick up the individual floppies, but I saw those covers and yeah, I've always thought they looked great. I really liked his style on those. Issue 3, the one that's been reprinted, I know, I'd seen that one a lot. I liked that first cover, just the close-up of the face with the blood. Like you, I never thought of that as alien blood or the alien saliva. I just thought this thing clearly just went to town on somebody and it's just kind of like flowing out of its mouth. The thing about the first cover is the gums over its lips were like a little bit too fleshy color. That, more than the color of the blood, throws me. Just because like Dave Dorman is sort of synonymous with all of these, like, you know, Star Wars pictures and Indiana Jones and covers for all of these Dark Horse properties that I was reading at the time. I kind of like the Arthur Sidham covers just because they feel more distinct. They feel a little bit more personal to the story. For instance, the omnibus that I've got, the volume 2, which has the story in it, has Dave Dorman covers from, like, pictures from Tribes. Tribes is not collected in this. He did so many aliens pictures that they kind of became ubiquitous, and they're used for a lot of different things. So
him and Beauvais both, they're like, yeah, they go to alien guys when you just need a stock image of an alien as a chapter header or as a cover for one of the omnibuses. Those are two of your main guys to reach for, him and Bolton, of course.
The Sidham covers, especially the later ones that are kind of like of that world, like they feel more alien almost. They don't have that photorealistic quality. They feel a little bit weirder. I like your comparison to like the Warren covers or something something like that. There's almost a bit more of a heavy metal aspect to it.
He's always had a very strong Frank Frazetta influence.
Yeah.
And I think that comes into play. And aliens tend to be smooth and metallic and wet. Amsterdam is dirty and muddy and earthy. And so they feel a little softer, a little weathered, a more aged, more organic. Part of the unearthliness of the aliens is how inorganic they are. It's a different take. And I guess it depends on your aesthetic preferences, whether or not you go for it. I generally don't. I've never been a big Saddam fan. He does the colors for this story, and I really don't like the coloring in the story at all, in part because he has that tendency toward those muddy colors. I'm not as into the cover. I like that one. That one cover is very striking to me, and it's memorable to me, but it doesn't really reflect anything in the story itself. And so, aside from that cover, I don't respond well to Saddam's involvement with the aliens.
Yeah, I hear everything you say, and I'm not the biggest fan of Arthur Sydam, just because, for one thing, Marvel Zombies, but also just like hearing
the stories,
some of his practices
the con
at
stuff,
cons,
yeah.
And like hearing about his behavior, I just kind of got the impression he's not a guy I would want to associate with. I like the covers in this case because they feel so distinct and so alien from the concept of the aliens, too. So it's just a little bit different. It's something that I wouldn't necessarily see. So I like those covers. And I like the covers to Alien 3, the adaptation, too.
The actual interior artwork, though, by Damon Willis. This is basically his book, because while he did other work in comics, not very much and not stuff that people generally saw. His main work was for Apple Comics' Blood of Dracula, which was generally written by Ricky Shanklin. And that's one of those books that was always on my periphery. Like when I first started getting into comic book shops, that had some degree of notoriety, but I never actually read an issue of it. And then he did the Out of the Vortex series, one of the longer lasting books to spin out of Dark Horse Comics' Greatest World, but ultimately didn't amount to a lot. He did a few odd Impact comics, but for the most part, the only thing anybody knows him from, the only thing that really got eyeballs was this, and then he fell off the face of the earth. Generally speaking, you said a little bit about what you thought about the art. My feeling is that I like him as an artist. There's a lot of Alan Davis qualities to his artwork. I could definitely see him doing more like superhero type stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoy the artwork. I just don't know that it's necessarily the artwork I want for an Aliens book. And it definitely soft sells the horror aspects. I think he's good for the action. And I think that the story that's being told here, he is a good fit. It's just that this isn't the alien story I necessarily want to read. And he's not necessarily the artist I want to have on an Aliens book. But I think he's a good artist. And I think he does a good job here.
Yeah. And I think part of it is the future tech that they do and the spacesuits and the armors and everything. Like, I mean, I can see him doing a more bombastic sci-fi fantasy story. Playing into something a little bit more fantastical in that realm, a sci-fi superhero story, like you said.
I think it's because the Alan Moore. I mean, sorry, I think it's
Alan Davis.
Because the Alan Davis faces in particular.
I see that too.
Yeah, I keep flashing to like Excalibur. It's like, why didn't this guy have like an Excalibur run instead? You know.
And actually, like I was kind of thinking, well, you know, his faces are fairly distinct amongst the named characters, but now I'm looking at two consecutive pages. There's one of that Dr. Bagali guy, and then the other picture is Jastrow, the guy with the saxophone, and they look identical the way he draws them. You'd think they were the same character.
But he puts in the work, man. He drew an awful lot of damned aliens in this thing.
Oh, sure. Yeah. No, I agree. For the story, I think the art works. And there's like really, some really strong panels and some really cool compositions and things I like in this. And some of like the spotlights of like the face hugger and the hologram coming out of the dark. I think those are great little moments. But yeah, maybe you're right. Maybe it's more of a tonal thing that it's just, this isn't the right type of alien story that should be.
And I'll say this too. I liked the story until I didn't. It's like, I read the first few issues and I was reading it in trade paperback as well. And usually I like to try to like stop after an issue and do something else and come back to it so I can feel that break. But I was able, the flow was working so well and there wasn't a clear chapter break. So I just kept going with it for a while there. And I was into it until I wasn't. And mostly it was the stuff we've talked about. I kept running into these roadblocks to my enjoyment. I'm also not a big fan of the whole berserker trope. That was something that was really big in the 80s where somebody goes nuts and you rip his arm off and he's still killing like crazy. Like I don't buy into that. I don't see that that's valuable to the military, really, that kind of thing. But ultimately, I came to the conclusion, again, is I think it's the plot that gets in my way. I think Arcudi, I've enjoyed his work elsewhere. I think he's got good dialogue. I enjoy reading the story, the actual process of reading the story more. I just, the plot gets in the way for me.
Yeah, Yeah, that, I agree. And just like a turn for like the characters, like Henriksen. Okay, he's obviously something bad about this guy that's telegraphed, but he's not a synth. And then at the end, he turns a traitor. Well, of course he is, but why? Like, okay, he was bought out by this rival company. They could have explained that a little bit better, because he also seems to have like some of his dialogue makes it sound like he has this like self-righteousness about him. He calls Grant like the rich boy or something like that. The physical confrontation, despite how much bigger and stronger he is, he gets beaten down and overwhelmed, and it just, I didn't buy it. And then you're right, yeah, so they give him the zip, so he goes nuts, but he doesn't attack them. He goes straight for the aliens to defend them. It's just, yeah, it didn't make sense.
The Trump parallels too is like, of course he's going to glom on to the biggest, most overt symbol of masculinity available to him. It's just hard to like not see parallels when you see shit like that happening. But the guy's a saboteur. He's working for a rival corporation. That would suggest a need for a low profile. So maybe not the 6'4" muscle bound guy who gets into fights and like really makes himself overt. And also, if you're a saboteur, why would you be shooting the chest burster that's in lockdown? How is that going to really impact on the long-term plan? Why would you want to telegraph in that manner? So there's a lot of reasons why this is really not the guy to be your saboteur. It's just bad plotting, I think, to be honest with you.
Stuff just happens in the story. Yeah.
I keep getting flashbacks to like Jim Shooter on Starbrand and such.
Yeah.
The writer proxy shit. There's stuff that happens in here because somebody has a particular view of things and doesn't have perspective on how other people might have contrary views of what they expect from their heroes and from their storytelling.
Yeah.
So we beat this down, I think.
Yeah. I mean, ultimately, it's disappointing because there are some interesting, there are some very cool ideas in the story, and there are at least two, if not more, story kernels or threads in the story that could have netted some really interesting fodder for alien stories, for the raid, the civil war, the weird genetic factioning off of these aliens and that whole study. But A, they're all thrown into the mix, into a pot together, and the more interesting ideas aren't fully developed. The story they do go with doesn't make a whole lot of sense, and it's all contingent on a protagonist that nobody should care about and want to actually succeed. And it's all bottled up with a name that does not make sense for any of the stories that they're trying to tell.
And it's four issues, guys. You know, yeah. Know your limitations.
Yeah.
One other thing, I'm not above biting somebody else's bit, but I hadn't planned to do this, and I got surprised several times. But Crab kept coming at me with, you know, what Ryan would do is he would want to know what page of artwork from the story you would want to own. And both times you caught me flat-footed. So knowing that you were coming,
oh.
I'm like, okay, I'm going to have to see if Daly has his own already in mind. So do you have a page picked out of this miniseries? Or am I catching you flat-footed the way Crab kept catching me flat-footed?
I wasn't ready for it, but
I feel like you're going to end up picking the same one as me, too, from something you said earlier, but I'm waiting to find out for sure.
I think if it was a page of original art, it would be the page when Grant wakes up from the cryo sleep.
Now, I think there's an important distinction. The page where it ends with the alien, or the page with the major and the full-bodied alien?
The page that ends with the alien.
Same here. I had that feeling when you mentioned it. Same here.
It's three kind of horizontal panels with a few insert panels to kind of like show his eyes opening and growing huge as this kind of just shadowy object takes image in front of him to see the alien there with, you see its inner jaws about to give him the kiss.
Yeah, it's a well-constructed page, and you have that really nice detailed shot of the alien at the end of it. Yeah, I'm totally with you.
However, if I was to approach an artist at a convention and commission a sketch of an alien, I would ask for an alien holding a saxophone.
There you go.
Aliens was written and directed by James Cameron and stars Sigourney Weaver, Paul Reiser, and Michael Biehn. This is HBO Behind the Scenes.
Probably noticed this conceit already, but I it occurred to me before this recording, since it's aliens and since we're dealing so much with colonial marines, that's why I keep saying Crab, as in the last name. Would you like to have a rank? And would you like, because you know, when I do the blog post, I actually come up with an icon for you and I use a name. But especially with you, with your G.I. Joe background, would you actually like to be like Corporal Daly, Major Daly, anything like that?
Oh, no, I would be busted down so low. I'd be Private First Class, just PFC Daly. I could not advance any further.
Okay. Be a squad. 21st Century Boys, A.J. Duckey, Angel M. Morales, Best Book Monkey Loves Horror Books, Between the Pages Blog, Billy Hines, BotTalk.com, CH.
Canoes, Chris A. Field, Otherverse Games, Chris Dunford, Chris Leiden, 40K Krista, DeBeige, Dear Watchers, a Marvel What If podcast, Del Dracula, Doc Strange, Dirk Ashton, The Ghoul Queen of Latex, Hello Berlin, History of Comics on Film, I Was Joe Is, Jeffrey Brown They Them, Joe M. Sontag, Keith G. Baker, King Dinosaur, Kirk Spencer, 40% Approval Rating and Climbing, Lamar the Elf Revenger, Long Box of Darkness, Lucretia, Matt J. Garner, Mike at Send Aliens to Me, Moose the Hobo with the High Kick Matson, Ramona's Power Hour, Richard Dent, Right Between the Eyes Podcast, Ryan Daly, Siskoid, Tomas Corsi, Tora, and Wonder Woman Warrior for Peace Podcast, Stefan the Best 1992, at Un Petit It, follow us on Tumblr, where Mega Furry Enemy Collection and VHS Killer like the image gallery for Book 3, Earth War 1990, Phoenix and Space Fox 189 liked Aliens Omnibus 1, while Del Dracula liked Aliens vs. Predator 1989 through 90.
This has been a Roald Spine podcast. All audio samples are believed covered under fair use laws. No copyright infringement is intended.
Coming in February, Aliens Hive. With guest Siskoid.